Welcome back to Schizotopia. As always, I'm your host, Maxwell Cody. And joining me once again, the Dorlor himself, Mr. Dorian Z. Bell, a.k.a. Dank DeLuz. Danko, how are you?
Oh boy, howdy. I'm pretty... I'm not good. I'm gonna be honest. I'm
not... I thought this time for sure you'd be doing great.
No, I always think about it and I think... Will today be the day? And I do an inventory, you know. I don't pre-decide these things. And I look deep into my soul, and then I realize I'm still bad.
But how bad? Medium bad? Medium rare? Medium raw?
I'll just say I feel well done, and I could use a drink.
Oh, a drink of what?
A drink of alcohol, sir.
Oh, which is still legal, I believe.
I think so. I've been... avoiding looking it up, just in case something has changed. You know, if I don't know that we've entered into a new prohibition, unless we have we?
Part of the Green New Deal, actually, the liberals want to take away alcohol.
No burgers, no beer.
No burgers, no beer. Everything will be consumed through vape.
Which will also be banned, which is very confusing to me.
you trade carbon credits. For illicit vape, right?
For mango jewel pods. Right. Yeah.
There's a dual lottery.
I like that. But I hear that the burgers and the beers, AOC comes over to your house herself and then steals it with her feet.
Well, you had me at AOC comes, so.
You dog.
Anyway, the thing that I have dragged you here to talk to me about tonight is dopamine the new alcohol?
Mm-hmm.
I remember a while back, I watched this interview with William Gibson, and I'm sure I've brought this up on this show before, and I'm sure the clip is out there somewhere. But basically, he says something along the lines of, when we read Victorian literature, when we read literature from the 19th century, it's obvious to us that the thing they're struggling with is sexuality. They just can't ever quite say it. It's the thing, you know, the Industrial Revolution has unleashed all this kind of sexual energy. People are becoming anonymous citizens within cities. They're no longer part of nice conservative little towns that would keep them in line. And now there's all this weird sexual tension and nobody knows what to do with it. And he says, in the future, the thing that people will probably make us look like hicks, the thing that will be very obvious to people in the future reading about, you know, 21st century literature or late 20th century literature, whatever, science fiction, will be this struggle between the reality, the real and the virtual. That's the thing that, like, we can't. That's the thing we're struggling with. We don't know what to do with it. And probably, you know, we talk about sex as a way of compensating for that.
Right. Right. And I mean, that just makes me feel like there's got to be some kind of Lacanian way to link it all, right? Where the sex has just become, I mean, this is our version of sex in a thousand ways. Like, first off, just everyone's addicted to, like, internet porn, but that's the obvious thing. But there's also the fact that at least in Lacanian psychoanalysis, you have this conflict between the fact that sex is part of the real, like it's this noumenal quality which requires something of you and your psyche that you then have to reconcile through desire, which never can access that. So our relationship to sex to begin with is one that is just a conflict between the real and the virtual, right? So it's just a, like everything else, a further abstraction of the problem that we already had and pretended we managed to grapple with.
Well, the thing that I think is funny about the internet porn discourse is that all the focus on, you know, having your brain rotted by the internet goes on to internet porn, right? But what's funny about that to me is I always feel like that's a way of avoiding talking about video games, social media, like food porn, right? Like everything has been pornified now. Even my favorite, internet blood sports, where people will have these like really mean debates, right?
Right.
On Twitch or whatever, but then those will get broken down into like compilations where it'll be like so-and-so owns so-and-so compilation or best of, you know, Vaush or Jay Dyer or whatever. And so then you don't even have to actually watch the debate. You just get the money shot of like them insulting or owning the other guy. And often when I used to watch a lot of this stuff, when you actually go back and you look at the context of some of these clips, it's not really that epic of an own, right? It's kind of like you wouldn't have noticed it unless you had edited it down. And I'm like, well, this is more porn than porn. This is even faker than porn, right? But just an interesting, or this, I've been looking up some facts about our internet usage, our internet addiction. Before the pandemic, the average American was on the internet for 12 hours and 24 minutes a day.
Your word.
So more than half of the day. So they're already online more than they are offline. Then during the pandemic and since the pandemic, it's shot up to 16 hours and 6 minutes. So even if we go like back to pre-pandemic levels of internet, we still spend more time. The average American is still spending more time on internet than in so-called reality. And I only bring this up with a certain level, with a little bit of relish, with a little bit of vindication, because people are always saying to me, oh, like Max, you focus too much on these like internet microcultures, or you focus too much on, you know, these terminally online people. And what I'm saying is like, well, everybody's terminally online now. Online is the real now. That's the thing that we're struggling with. That's the thing that we're being puritanical about.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's I love the idea that you know, if some people's sleep hygiene is appropriate, right? There are some imaginary people out there that actually do sleep 8 hours a night, right? That those people are spending like 15 minutes of their sleep still on the internet. I like that idea.
Like there are, yes, exactly. They're falling asleep. They're nodding off like while still on Twitter and even
right.
Like,
they're still scrolling.
I mean, I have been guilty of this, where I fall asleep on the couch. I wake up because my phone vibrates. I send somebody a response when I'm really literally not conscious, not fully conscious, right? And then the sad thing is, you think they'd be like funny or weird, but they're actually mundane. You know, even if I don't remember sending them, they're about what I would have said anyway. And somehow that's the most disappointing part. If it was funny, weird dream speak, at least it would be worthwhile.
No, I've had exactly the same thing, like sleep texting, and it's always just, hey, yeah, Saturday's good. Yeah, all right, cool. Thanks. which is why I'm on all these podcasts, because I agree to them when I'm asleep.
31%, according to Pew, 31% of American adults are online basically at all times. So I'm guessing that means people who are on even more than 16 hours, which that's one third of the population.
Dear Lord. I mean, it makes sense, because I mean, I don't know about you. I imagine you have the same degree of this disease as I do. But, you know, every time that I open up my phone to check the time, keep in mind, I wear a watch. So it's entirely unnecessary. But every time that I open up my phone to check the time, it then enters into like a order of operations where then I, without even thinking about it, look at the time, check Instagram, check my email, check this, check that, go back, check the time again because it didn't process the first time, and then close up the phone. And all of that happens in just like, you know, a few seconds, And then, of course, I'm going to do it 5 minutes later because I probably don't remember what time it was anyway.
I was going to say, I'm glad that you actually managed to get the time check first, because I'll go to check the time and I forget all about the time. Yeah. And then I'm like reading a 20 tweet thread about esoteric Tibetan phrenology or something. And I'm like, oh God, what the fuck am I doing back in this cesspool? I got to get out of here. And then I have to go back and check my phone again because I didn't actually look at the time. I actually bought 2 digital watches so that I could just wear a watch and not have to check my phone to check the time because of this exact thing. And ended up breaking both of those watches, right? Because it's almost like I don't even know how to wear a watch anymore.
Right. Were you doing a Giuliani where you were wearing a watch on either hand?
I should have done that. That's going to be what I do next. I'm going to do. Yeah. I'm going to do it Soviet tank commander style and have 4 fucking watches. But what was I thinking? I end up missing the fucking time entirely. And then having checked several times. I think the most embarrassing one is I go to set a timer for something I'm cooking. And then I don't set the timer. I get sucked into whatever stupid thing is going on in internet world. And then my food burns.
Right.
That's got to be, you would think that would be the most bottom of the barrel one where you would finally be like, I need to change my life.
No.
But no. It doesn't, right?
Well, because the problem, it's so slippery. It totally evades any kind of solution because the problem is that you end up engaging all of your focus in such a way that's habitually dissipating all of the memory that you end up that you would have developed based off of what you're focusing on. That was kind of jumbled, but instead of focusing on things and then using that as a way to store memories, the weird attention economy of the internet, I feel, ends up grabbing your attention, and then because it pulls it in so many directions, or because it's really just a repetition of whatever you did 5 minutes ago, just with different information, but the information doesn't ultimately matter, it's all just form, that you store zero memories of anything that you were doing with it. And so it's like
alcoholism is what it's
exactly
like.
It's like it's alcoholism like and it's a disease where you don't even remember your symptoms, right? Like the symptoms don't actually occur to you until you start seeing them affect your sober life, right?
Yeah. I think one of the worst is the double screening where you're like binge watching like a shitty show. Dude. On your TV, and then you're like, well, I don't really have to focus on Frasier. I can just let that run. That can be like, that can be my surrogate family, right? There's the laugh track and everything. Yeah. So that's giving me a nice little dopamine baseline. And then on top of that, I'll throw some fucking Twitter or Instagram group chat insanity. And that'll be like the fun part. This is like the equivalent of having like a information speedball, right? You got the stimulant through social media, and then you got the depressant through 90s television.
You know, and I've been trying to and mostly failing, but trying to move away from that a little bit, because there really was a period that I'm still in, where in order to focus on something like writing, or fuck, even reading, which is nightmarish in its own way, where I would have to totally bombard my senses with electronic stimuli of various sorts, right? So a show playing in the background with music, maybe something that I can actually focus on if it is writing, so that I can kind of like dribble out the writing if I'm reading, hopefully there's nothing else, and then still checking my phone and shit as it's occurring. So, you know, mm-hmm. 4 inlets of stimulus, all just pummeling me, because it's the only way that I could get myself to focus. It's bad.
I remember, I think it's Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, I'm pretty sure. One of Philip K. Dick's novels, where like the Martian colonists buy these little doll sets, and then they do this drug that lets them merge with the doll set.
Nice.
And that's how they sort of just cope with being living in the brutal conditions of Mars. And I remember when I was a heavy Kratom user, when I was riding the Green Dragon. And by the way, everybody, I'm 1 year free from the Green Dragon. It's been one year since I've taken any Kratom. I know because I took Kratom the week the new Batman movie came out. And after that, I was like, I'm done.
That's funny. I'm a little bit over a year without using it because it's illegal where I live now. It's
prohibition.
Yeah,
we'll get into the effectiveness of prohibition shortly. But what I do remember when I was taking a lot of Kratom and I was basically like double screen gooning, you know, or I'd have the show on behind the TV show behind the social media. I remember being like, this is like the shittiest version of this three stigmata thing that Philip K. Dick was talking about, right? It's so much, it's basically the same. You're taking this drug in order to basically slip into this fantasy world more easily. But it's just not as cool as how it was described in the science fiction novel. And it never ceases to amaze me. It never ceases to amaze me how science fiction often, the science fiction I grew up on has become real, but it's always in the shittiest way possible. It's never in the cool way that it was originally described.
Yeah, yeah. I had similar thoughts when I was using it, but instead of about sci-fi, it was something that's maybe a little bit more trite. But it was just thinking of like De Quincey and like the opium eaters kind of thing, and just thinking like, this is the lamest possible version of that, where I get sort of high, and I have some kind of more fantastical thoughts. And of course, you know, being one of us fucking around on my computer instead of, you know, smoking opium, laying down on a carpet somewhere and entering into the mystical fantasy land of my own internal thoughts and writing something worth reading. It's we're stuck. Here we are.
I had you, I didn't think you'd watch the whole thing, but I got you to watch Ken Burns' Prohibition documentary.
Look, man, I love you.
Love you too, buddy.
I don't know how much I love Ken Burns.
Well, how did you like the documentary at least? Did you get anything?
Yeah, it was all right. It was pretty interesting. So the last time I really spent any time thinking about Prohibition was many years ago. And of course, the part that was interesting to me was the bootlegging and the mob stuff and stuff like that. And I found that in the documentary, that was the most boring part of it for me. But that was also part three, so it's like maybe I was just burnt out. It was really interesting to me about the beginning with the women's movements and everything, and how much it really just felt like group chat schisms, you know, where you had one of the main women. There were a lot of women starting a lot of groups that, but she ended up starting one of these prohibition or the, these one of these dry groups because of the fact that she wasn't allowed to speak at some conference, and then she made it so that one of the rules for her group is that no man would be allowed to like even speak at their meetings, and that just felt so much like some anarchist split in like a Mastodon chat or something like that.
We're starting a new reading group.
It was so funny.
Wieners allowed.
Fuck you. Fuck you. What was that?
No wieners allowed.
Right.
The reason why I started thinking about that documentary recently is because where he starts off is he starts off with the Industrial Revolution, and the Industrial Revolution, you know, becomes industrial agriculture, which suddenly makes grain cheaper than it's ever been. There's just this insane overabundance of grain, which means now there can be an insane overabundance of cheap alcohol. And what is the result of that? The average American starts drinking the equivalent of 7 gallons of grain alcohol a year. And to put that into perspective, apparently Americans today are now drinking about what they were drinking just before Prohibition was passed. And that's about a little over 2 gallons of grain alcohol per year. Meaning if you took all the alcohol out of the average person's drinks, right? I don't mean 2 gallons of beer, just to be clear here. I don't mean 2 gallons of liquor. I mean, if you took all the alcohol, like somehow sucked all of the alcohol out of everybody's drinks on average, and filled up a couple jugs, you would get about 2.5 gallons of pure grain alcohol. Two and a half gallons of Everclear. So that's, and that's like a, that's a lot of alcohol. But at our height in like the mid 1800s, we were at about 7 gallons on average of grain alcohol. We were just absolute fucking alkies. And it puts into perspective where this, you know, prohibitionist thinking begins, because this ends up being something that the whole political spectrum starts to agree on, or at least the radicals do. Like there's this massive horseshoe effect where the Klan, the socialists, the women suffragists, they all come together to say, we got to defeat the bottle. That becomes the focus of all of the ills of society. And I'm just going to draw a parallel with that today. I mean, if I'm saying that the internet has become the new alcohol, it's going to be the new, it's going to be the thing that we struggle with, the virtual and our obvious addiction to it. If you have people who are basically screen-aholics, you know, or dopamine-aholics, and it's like one-third of the population is severely addicted, and at least two-thirds of the population are heavily affected, it's going to breed something as reactionary as prohibition, I would imagine.
Right. And, well, two things. First off, because I've been doing a lot of brewing and I'm autistic, I had to do the math to figure out how much they were really drinking. It sounds like that's, if my math is right, and I'm terrible at math, that's like 4 beers a night, every night, for a year. And I don't know, that's, that seems like some bitch shit, frankly. But they could do better.
But if it's seven gallons of grain alcohol on average, wouldn't that mean that half the population is drinking even more than that?
I hope so. because I mean, just in the sense that it makes me feel a little bit better, because that's, I'm at that point easily right now. And I've cut down significantly after changing careers. But the other part, I mean, the thing that's really fascinating to me about it is that this is, and I didn't even think about this quantity until now, but the fact that it was resultant from the Industrial Revolution and an increase in you know, of available resources, and how you could line that up with, you know, like processing power, and the explosion there. I hadn't thought about that until you brought that up. That's really fascinating.
We're in the era of cheap dopamine. Dopamine's never been cheaper in human history.
Right.
And I don't know. I feel like when you look at it that way, you can, I feel like you got to let us off the hook a little bit, because no generation of human beings, especially us, we millennials who are like on the cusp of all this shit, no generation of human beings was ever exposed to this much cheap dopamine.
Right.
The fact that it's actually, when you think of it that way, it's like, it's shocking that we're doing as well as we are. But right. It just seems to me in the future, and I'm saying in the not too distant future, like people are going to look at all of the conflicts of today, whether it's true or not, they're going to look at it as this is what cheap dopamine did to society.
Yeah. I wouldn't even disagree with them. you know? Yeah. And on top of that, you know, one reason I would assume you're able to have like such wild consumption of both of these goods, you know, content producing dopamine or alcohol, without the market just totally falling apart, is the fact that once you end up meeting all of the available demand, the demand necessarily increases, because you end up, because that's how addiction works, right? And that's how tolerance mm-hmm. works. So that's another really fascinating one, is the fact that it is itself like necessarily kind of escalating. It's a cybernetic cycle, right? Like this is all just circuitry that's only going to make itself more intense. What do you think is responsible? I mean, I have some thoughts, but what do you think is responsible for the amount of drinking dropping over time, and how might we find a parallel to that here?
I mean, I know that like Well, maybe what it is that society passed through this chasm where it was like there was this age that Ken Burns talks about, this age. I didn't realize in the 1800s, like how intense the alcoholism was.
Right.
And so maybe it's like, yes, prohibition didn't succeed in eliminating alcohol from our society, but maybe that experience changed our culture to a certain degree. Maybe it tamed us a little bit. Because even in the US today, you know, in most of the country, you can't drink outside.
Right.
There's still dry counties or, you know, out here in the Midwest, I know there's places where they just don't sell alcohol or they don't sell liquor on Sundays. So you have to go to the bar or whatever. So there's still like the cultural vestiges of prohibition. It's almost like we kind of made a new agreement with alcohol after going through the trauma, quote unquote, of extreme alcoholism, then all the problems that prohibition bred. And then like, you know, the elation of prohibition being overturned. Because the interesting thing is when prohibition was overturned, alcoholism didn't shoot up, stayed about the same. You know, it didn't really move the needle, but still we'd come to like a new cultural consensus. And you know, in Europe, and here's the thing. In Europe, teen drinking is less, even though you can buy alcohol at a younger age. You can start buying beer and wine at 16 in most European countries. And then even then, they don't really enforce that either. So there's people who still are able, I know in a lot of European countries, you just start drinking when you're 14. But you don't drink as much and they don't have as many alcohol-related problems among teenagers because they have a more sophisticated culture. You know, your family starts giving you wine when you're relatively young. So it's not like some really naughty or exotic thing. Where in America, I think as another vestige of our, whatever you want to call it, our Puritanism or our experience of prohibition, like binge drinking among teenagers is like a rite of passage. And it's something that like, I think wipes a lot of kids out because they have no experience with alcohol. If they grow up in a really strict family, then they go to college and they just get absolutely destroyed by the bottle. Like they don't know how, they have no context for it. So I don't know. I mean, we definitely drink less than we did in the 1800s, but like, America still has a weird alcohol problem. We still have an unhealthy relationship with it. Actually, we manage it better, but we didn't actually solve that problem. I guess what I'm saying is with this dopamine rush that we're living in, it's clearly pulling at the fabric of society. And it would be like, how bad is it going to get? Cause we were talking about like just the amount of wasted time, right? Like, or just this sort of gooning where you're like double screening or you're zoning out on social media or whatever, on YouTube, whatever. What about people who like lost years of their life to QAnon or Flat Earth or all of these other things, which basically they got inducted to through a dopamine based algorithm or an algorithmic dopamine cycle that they got locked into until they'd adopted a worldview they never would have adopted in a million years without the internet. Because I think people in the future, they're going to be looking back, assuming we don't all kill ourselves, right? They're going to be looking back and they're going to be like, this was the age of everybody being addicted to dopamine and literally going insane. And I guess I'm wondering, it's like, will the end be, I've talked often about no phoners, which I think is already happening, and it's happening at the bottom of society and it's happening at the very tippy top of society. Cause all these elite techies in Silicon Valley, they're raising their kids without screens. And that in the future will be a sign of, that's almost like a sign of being like landed gentry now or something. It's a sign of being civilized that you don't have to grow up on a screen.
Right.
And that's obviously going to give these kids an advantage when they grow up. It's not going to be a disadvantage for them. And then there's going to be people at the bottom of society, kind of like punks or whatever, who are going to, I think, become Luddites and say, well, we're going to reject screens as much as possible. We're going to live off the grid as much as possible. Even if it makes my life harder in the immediate, in the present, it'll be better for me in the long run or something like that.
Right. Well, and especially because it makes it harder, right? It's like, the freegans and stuff like that. Like there's, you're going to get clout off of the inconvenience of not being online.
And so I guess what I've been struggling with is like, you know, maybe it's going to be worse than alcohol. I would have never thought that, but it's maybe really in the future, people will be like the dopamine rush was way worse than the grain alcohol rush.
I mean, I think it already is. In a lot of different senses, and the one that really kind of gets to me is that, you know, even if you live in a society where everyone is drunk all the time, you're still going to have a village drunk who's way too fucking drunk. And it's super identifiable and it's super damaging in a really obvious way. It's not a subtle, nuanced kind of situation. With this, you know, it's not only this, this kind of, sneaky, subtle kind of thing that everyone has kind of, become equally addicted to, but it's also this, there's a turn of phrase that Nick Land uses in his Bitcoin white paper, which is something I didn't think I'd be referencing here. But it's something to the tune of sedimentation is concealment, which is to say that it's kind of a Foucauldian thought, I think, but just the idea that when something becomes common enough, it becomes invisible, right? And so it's already damaging enough because it's just rotting people's brains out, but it's also that it's invisible even if we're all aware of it and complain about it all the time. So, I mean, it's like a cancer that you refuse to treat, you know, whereas with alcoholism, some people will have social pressures saying, stop doing that, you know, but what's going to happen is someone's going to say, don't look at your phone as much. And then you just do it sneakier. Like, well, I guess that works
well
too, but
I was going to say, maybe it'll be, I know people have made the comparison to cigarettes as well. I could see there being I'm going to guess in like Scandinavian countries, you're going to start seeing ads that, you know, shame people for looking at their phone or playing on their phone when they're with their family or friends. I can see this ad campaign clear as day, like some people hanging out and somebody starts texting and then, you know, they get shamed or whatever, or literally like, have the phone start puffing smoke, like it's the same as cigarettes. Right, and then have the people around them like waving away their dirty tweets or something, like it's dirty smoke. This sort of thing, like combining the two. I could see something like that, some kind of campaign like that. And I know, since we're trying to tie this to prohibition, I know when the U.S. was having its prohibition movement, in, I think it was like the Baltic countries, they had their own temperance movement, but instead of giving up alcohol, it was just trade vodka for beer. Because people were drinking several pints of vodka every single day. And so the idea was, we're never going to get men here to stop drinking. That is out of the question, but we can just try to give them beer. And that became their temperance movement, living in their prohibition. Just drink beer. Just get as drunk as you want on beer. Just stop getting completely blacked out on vodka every day.
So we're all going to swap out our smartphones for laptops.
Yeah, you can have as much laptop time as you want but you won't be able to carry it around in your pocket, you know, something like that. I could see people going back to brick phones. Whoever comes out with,
I know some people that have done that. Yeah. I've thought about it.
All you need, if you could just have a Nokia phone that just has like maybe GPS and Uber on it or something like that.
Right.
So, you know, you're able to retain a few modern conveniences on it, but otherwise it's designed to not let you drift off into dopamine world. It's just, the thing is because there's so much money invested in this stuff and because our whole economy revolves around it now, it will take some kind of disaster, right? There will have to be some kind of like a level of social degradation high enough to get people to change. And what's interesting to me is I know that crack cocaine dropped off massively after about 20 years. And it was because the first generation of crackheads had arrived. Basically, it was like the first generation it was for the first time you could actually see people whose lives had been destroyed by crack cocaine. Because when crack cocaine first came out, I was talking to an old head about this once in Oakland. They were saying, you know, when crack cocaine first came out, it was awesome, and there was no stigma around it. It was just really cheap cocaine that let you party even longer and harder than you ever had in your entire life, and everybody loved it. There was no one had heard of a crackhead yet. And it was about, you know, 10, 15 years, 20 years, whatever it was, when you really had like crackheads become a staple of that town. Like you're talking about like the person who's obviously negatively affected, like the town drunk. Mm. And then once that person emerged and the younger people could see that, and they could see that that's what it would lead to, that's when like crack usage actually like fell off a little bit. And I'm guessing maybe with alcohol, probably a process like that happened. The only thing is like, I don't really see Gen Z going offline. When I was trying to look up all these statistics about internet usage, like they're using the internet even more than millennials. And maybe part of that's just because they're young and they have more time. But I don't know. They're not looking at, I would assume Gen Z would look at how fucked up millennials are and be like, what can we do to not be like this?
Well, it's also, you know, how fucked up millennials are is kind of split between a couple things that hides it, right? So first off being that, you know, a lot of it is kind of sequestered away, or placed onto the internet where everyone is insane, just in different ways. And then the rest of it, we get to blame on boomers, right? So I think Gen Z is just kind of rolls their eyes and doesn't think too hard about us unless they need to make an insult, which is fair. So again, I think it's the fact that we don't have the type of extreme visibility of any of these problems that is anomalous for it to have any effect. Because again, it has to be anomalous for it to have an effect. Like how racist boomers are, it certainly has not stopped us from like developing really racist right wing movements in the millennial generation, right? Like,
well, the people who hate the boomers for not being racist,
right? Yeah, yeah.
You see a lot of that on Twitter, that the boomers were soft,
right?
that's why
such a fascinating kind of result. Because I remember thinking in high school, even then, like that was probably. Well, not probably. It was definitely the most conservative I've ever been in my life, at least like politically, not necessarily how I acted. But I remember thinking, oh, well, I guess just conservatism is more or less dead now because we're only going to continue moving into this kind of soft leftward kind of direction because that's what all my peers look like. And then there are a few other like conservatives. And I cannot believe how fucking naive that was.
Yeah.
Well, it was like a crazy thought.
Go ahead.
No, the other thing about the internet addiction with Gen Z is that, you know, we've had to contend with a lot of weaponized dopamine for sure. But you think about the kind of the gradual slide that we had into it, you know, like in the eighth grade, I was still using like an electronic typewriter, like a word processor.
Oh, wow! Right?
So, you know, we're fucking old people, and then right. You know, very soon after that was there was like MySpace, which is the most primitive shit in the universe, and so comparing how our slide in kind of worked, and then even our most pernicious, powerful dopamine weapon that's used on us, like Instagram or something like that, it's still nothing compared to someone that was born into using TikTok, essentially, right?
Yeah.
Like just a constant slide of short videos, custom made to just run through you like diarrhea and just erase all experience it makes sense to me that they're as addicted, if not worse.
The only way that I can like sympathize with boomers who just got destroyed by QAnon is how I had to delete TikTok because I've never been more addicted to a fucking app.
Right.
As soon, like I could not stop looking at it, and it made me think of David Foster Wallace and like the infinite tape that would be so entertaining that you would just die. Right.
Yeah.
I was like, this is fucking it. It's TikTok. And I deleted TikTok, and like Kratom, I'm never touching that shit again because it is too powerful. And now I understand the boomers who didn't know anything about message boards or social media or memes or any of this shit, who got completely sucked in and destroyed by QAnon. I understand it because they weren't ready for that proof.
They didn't stand a chance. Yeah.
They weren't ready for that. Like that was like the white claw. That was the white claw of dopamine, right? It was just too good. It fucked them over. Let me be like the Four Loko of dopamine. And then TikTok, that's like the Everclear of dopamine. But I do want to talk about China a little bit, because all the way back in 2008, I like this up as well. All the way back in 2008, China officially labeled internet or video game addiction as like a national health crisis for them. And they built these boot camps to send kids to detox them from video games. And they're talking to one of the counselors or whatever, but it's funny because instead of, I was watching this video, instead of it being like rehab, how we do it, where it's like, you know, very medical and therapeutic and it's all, you know, white walls and group discussion or whatever, this is just military style. So like their therapist is just a guy in a military uniform. And what stood out to me is he was like, video games are electric heroin. And if you think about like China in the context of, you know, opium and opium wars and how opium was a weapon of war used against them by the British, the fact that they instantly draw that parallel between video games and opium stands out to me. Whereas it's funny, I've been thinking about it in as a form of alcoholism, because I guess that's my American bias, right? We in the US, we have this tradition of prohibition and temperance and all of that. But what interests me is that, one, that China's approach is just military boot camp style. We're just going to knock it out of these kids if they get too addicted to video games. Whereas with us, the only thing that I see us intervening on is how like TikTok has become, there's some national security dialogue around it where, and I don't know if this is true or not, I've heard this many times, but the idea is that in China, the TikToks that get boosted or pushed are the ones that are like telling kids to become scientists and engineers and stay in school and respect the party and that sort of stuff. Whereas the stuff that gets boosted in the West is like all the dumb shit, the like influencer, pee pee poo poo content. And the idea being that like social media now becomes a weapon of war. Social media now becomes something that the state has to intervene on. And I'm wondering, because I know people talked about banning TikTok, or there's been attempts to ban TikTok in the United States, if like the way that some of this shit ends is when it finally becomes a certifiable national security crisis. Now I sound like a spook, I know, but it's like, I'm just saying objectively, the only way this ends is when the military finally decides we can't have a population of people who can't agree on the shape of the planet and are at each other's throats about neo-pronouns and this type of shit, and it just has to be shut down.
Yeah, I mean, I figure that the only thing that can save you from a brave new world is 1984, right? Like if the problem is that you have too much information coming in, the only way to cure that is to essentially produce a command economy around the stimulation that you get, which itself is a terrifying kind of idea. Just the idea of like being able to ban apps and things of the sort. And that does happen. Like it's not without some form of precedent, but I'm just thinking like if they should have done this, but if the American government banned Facebook in, you know, 2011 or something, and what a shock that would be. Because me sitting right now, I'm like, yeah, ban TikTok, that sounds hilarious. But I've used TikTok all of like two times and I've deleted my account after each of the uses.
It's too good.
You know? So I don't have a relationship to it, but I certainly understand like how fucking insane it is, even after such a short use. But just thinking of, you know, the Gen Z kids and younger now that just have always been using this and are really as plugged into something as you possibly can be. And I mean, I guess we don't really, well, no, we have to care what Gen Z ends up thinking about these things because they're old enough to vote now. Do we believe in voting here?
Well, I mean, but, I believe that I'm not one of these people that says that voting has no effect. It's just less than people act like it does.
Exactly.
It does affect things, but it's really not worth screaming at people because, you know, all of the energy that we poured into arguing about the border wall, now we're going to have half a border wall. The energy we poured into arguing about the Iraq and Afghanistan war, we still were going to spend 20 years. I mean, whatever. I mean, it's just
exactly. It's not, everything gets co-opted into the center, so you might as well.
you please just go ahead and stay civil. And actually, that kind of ties into what I'm wondering is going to happen with Gen Z, because on one hand, here's my fucking absolute insane white pill. Okay, I wonder if like crack cocaine, Like the people who grew up seeing the actual effects and horrors of crack cocaine, and that was enough to stave them off. I wonder if a lot of Gen Z is going to grow up, they're going to see the negative effects of polarization and internet addiction and how bad it is, and they're going to almost reach this kind of like, they're going to brain origami themselves into this zen-like state where they kind of see past the foolishness of extreme ideologies. They all just collectively kind of become grill-pilled because they see how crazy and obnoxious it gets. They've seen the negative effects. They've seen the social media equivalent of crackheads, and they don't, it's ugly enough for them to be like, I don't need this. I just want to be, they'll almost be like the new silent generation. They'll be like, I just want to be a polite citizen with some decent economic prospects.
Do people grill pill or become grill pilled? Do people become grill pilled by proxy, more or less? Because I feel like most of the time, if not all of the time, the people that become grill pilled are just people who were so exhausted about being extreme that they moved on from it, rather than people that saw that everyone's being extreme and decided that they didn't want to have any part of it.
This guy who committed a mass shooting recently, and then his manifesto was about gun control.
Uh-huh.
Did you see this?
No, I didn't.
I mean, I was like, that's you. We reached something with this.
Hagel was right.
This is more schizo than anything I ever could have imagined. Like an anti-gun mass shooter. We're at anti-gun mass shooter. That's the level of fucking nuts that we've gotten to. And I just kind of think, I imagine kids will see that. I hope this is my white pill scenario that I'm hoping for. I'm hoping the younger kids will see this type of shit. And they will say, okay, like this is the equivalent of a screaming toothless crackhead shitting themselves under a bridge. I don't want to be part of this. This is not the party I want. That's my white pill. My black pill would be they get really, really good at escapism. That the next level of simulation, the next level of dopamine, the second dopamine rush is when people get really, really good at escapism, where you just have you're neuralinked to your ChatGPT family, hive mind, and life is just basically about, people go full lotus eater, I guess that would be the black pill. And maybe those two things will coexist to a certain level, but certainly one would have to prevail over the other. So I don't know. When I think about my own life, it is kind of sad to me. Some of my fondest memories are of me playing video games.
Right.
Those are some of my fondest childhood memories, but all of those games would now be considered quaint.
Yeah.
By today's standards. And even like Facebook, when I was like, MySpace, even when I was like a MySpace junkie, I always talk about this divide in my life. I remember the time where I would get off work or get home from school and I'd be excited to go on the internet. And now I'm excited to put my phone in a drawer and go on a walk without it so that I can be free from the internet.
Right.
And I'm sure that that experience of escape from the internet will be more intense for the Zoomers. And that might be me hard coping, but I'm thinking after the great reaction against the dopamine rush, however that manifests, I'm hoping that after that, people will have attained some kind of new cultural enlightenment. And maybe it'll be like with alcohol, where yes, there's still alcoholism and yes, alcoholism is still a problem, but we've reached some new cultural consensus where it's not like drinking 7 gallons of grain alcohol a year in the 1800s. And it's not prohibition, gang wars and government corruption like it was in the 20s. It's whatever consensus we reach now.
The only way out is through.
In which case, I don't know. I feel like accelerationism doesn't work here.
Maybe does it not?
Maybe
you
need.
I mean, is that what you're describing?
I guess I am. Fuck. You gotta. We'll have to pass through the TikTok civil war.
Yeah, it's coming. It's coming. And you know what? You know all the people I hear complaining about. You know, like climate change and using that as an excuse to not have kids, you know, that one always drives me crazy from people that live in the States, because they're pretending and they're coping and believing that we will somehow be so affected by climate change,
right,
instead of the rest of the world, that it's not even worth raising children in our first world space. But on the other hand, while that's not a valid reason, I think, not wanting to have anyone growing up using the internet is, I'm only half kidding, is a good enough reason to not want to have kids.
Oh, you don't, you mean you don't want a kid who, like, a screen kid?
Yeah, I don't want to bring life into the world that has to know what it's like to grow up using TikTok.
Yeah, I mean, well, okay, two things. One, the thing that has always driven me nuts about the no kids people is that the people I know who are very loud and proud about not having kids, they also always flex how they're able to consume more because they don't have kids.
Right, yeah.
Which, that's, I'm not, that's fine, unless you're trying to make the argument that you're not having kids to save the planet or something like that.
Yeah, yeah,
because then in place of the child, if you're just consuming way more, it's probably ends up being at least as bad, if not worse, for the planet, right? If you're constantly going on vacations or whatever, and I don't know, the no kids stuff, that what has always bothered me about that is that it always feels like it's meant to be revenge on their parents or something. Or there's always this.
Well, I think it is. Yeah. I think it is. It, you see, we're becoming like Peterson pilled again. But I think
Peterson pilled again.
He was right all along. But you know, people that don't want to have kids, you know, I don't have kids. I'm probably not going to have kids. Whatever. I think that's perfectly fine. But the people that are really adamant about that being like a part of their identity, that they would never want to bring kids into the world, I think most of the antinatalism stuff really is just derived from a resentment around having to be born and then not necessarily getting what they wanted out of life, be it through their parents or just the way that the reality is structured, right? And so, yeah, inherently you're mad at one dad or another. It's either Sky Dad or it's Dad Dad or it's some other dad.
Well, you know, there's the stereotype of the homophobe who's always ends up being a closet gay. And, you know, there's a lot of prominent examples of this. I have noticed over the years that there is a left-wing version of this. And that's that many people I knew who were very anti-heterosexuality, we'll put it that way, or very anti-tradition, anti-marriage, anti-kids, all of this stuff. The ones who are the loudest about this.
They're all trad wives now.
I know at least two of them, maybe three, who are now trad wives. And I mean, got married in a church in a white dress type of thing and now have kids. And so I'm kind of like, this is the left-wing version of the closeted homophobe.
Yeah.
this is the straight guilt that ends up turning into being trad. So yeah, there's that as well.
I mean, your anxiety is telling you the truth. Just usually not in the way that you think.
Was there anything else? I want to tell everybody to watch the movie Road to Wellville. Have you ever seen this movie?
I have not.
It's a movie I watched as a kid that freaked me out. And then as an adult, thinking about this stuff, it popped back into my head and I was like, I got to rewatch it. So I rewatched it recently. It's a decent movie. I can't say it's a great movie, but it's a decent movie. And I think everyone today should watch it because it's about Kellogg. And it's about the wellness institute that he ran. And he's like vehemently against animal products and he's vehemently against masturbation. So he's like
I didn't know the animal part. That's interesting.
Oh yeah, he's a hardcore vegetarian. So he's like the most annoying leftoid vegan and the most annoying rightoid nofap guy combined into one weird Victorian. And it's interesting to me how he prefigures this kind of modern day moralism. And once again, I think it's anxiety about the Industrial Revolution. Because the Industrial Revolution, you now have a bunch of meat. Because the Industrial Revolution, you've now unleashed a bunch of sexual energy. And that's what he's like concerned about. So he invents Kellogg's cereal, bland cereal, this whole idea of eating bland foods to keep you from, because the idea is that, you know, spicy foods are going to make you horny. You know, they stir up the passions and this sort of thing. And like, you need to live this bland, austere, kind of industrial Protestant life where you produce, but you do not consume. And it's interesting how that figure has been broken into two and sort of polarized on opposite sides of the spectrum now, where there's the people who are sex positive, quote unquote, who are saying, you know, never stop fapping. And then there's the people on the other side who say, don't fap under any circumstances. And it's perfectly designed to make you as fucking insane as possible. But anyway, right. The reason why I like Road to Wellville is you look back on it. And again, you see in the Victorians, you see what they're struggling with clearly that they can't. You see that they're struggling with living in this new industrial society. They don't know what to do with it. They don't know what to do with all these new energies that have been released into the world. And then with us, it's, we don't know how to deal with the virtual and real anymore. And we're in denial about it. And people are going to look back on us and they're going to laugh at us the same way that we're laughing at Kellogg and his boner belt thing, whatever the fuck he was doing.
I think ending this on boner belt thing is pretty perfect.
Boner belt. All right. Dorlor, thank you so much for indulging me once again. Where can people find you?
Thank
you. Anyone want to give a shout out, including yourself? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'd like to shout myself out for continuing to, you know, just to exist in this dystopian world, you know. That's Dank Deleuze on Instagram. That's really the only place it's worth checking. I got all the other things too, but except TikTok. I don't have a TikTok. Except I was thinking TikTok. About making one recently.
Too millennial for TikTok. Sorry.
Too millennial for TikTok. But otherwise, I do run a writing workshop where we talk about theory as well as go over people's art. It's not exclusively writing. I have a lot of visual artists, musicians, things of the sort in there as well. But that's at patreon.com/truncata, T-R-U-N-C-A-T-A. And that's all my shout outs.
All right. Boner belt. Boner belt. Boner belt. Boner belt. Boner belt. Boner belt. Boner belt.